Well, hi, everybody. I'm Paul Yeager. Welcome inside the MTOM Show Studio Podcast 2. 1.5, we'll be back in that very soon with a couple of guests that we hope that you like. But today, we are going global. We're going to go to Ukraine. We are going to talk to a farmer who is living life a whole lot different in 2022 at the end than they did at the beginning. Keyes Huizinga is our guest. We'll start with the correct pronunciation, his story, how he ended up in Ukraine. He's not native, but he certainly adopted his country, as he calls it, my country. A note, something happened in the middle of this interview that I've never had, and it absolutely highlights what is going on and what he is dealing with. So you're going to have to click and listen to the full episode here as we discuss some global politics about what's happening for him, his story. I ask him if he feels like he's going to get in a little bit of trouble for doing some of these interviews. And when I mean interviews, hours, I'm not saying that that's going to get him into trouble, but he was recently on a panel at the Borlaug Dialogues. That's how we came across him to learn more about what life is like there and what he's trying to do and grow and just trying to still have that market that doesn't exist right now. The exports are a whole heck of a lot harder than they used to be, than they were before the end of February. So that is what we're going to do today. Heavy politics in the sense of Ukraine. That's what we're going to talk about in this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. Keyes, first question, pronounce your last name for me. I want to make sure I get that right.
Huizinga.
One more time.
Huizinga.
So is that native to where?
To the Netherlands.
To the Netherlands?
Yeah.
Are you native to the Netherlands?
Yes, yes. It's not Ukrainian.
How'd you end up in Ukraine then?
Farming. I mean, when I started here in 2013, I think more than half of the country was fallow land. I came out of the Soviet Union only like 10 years before. And they didn't have money to do farming, so we could start cheaply. And they had these huge fields of this black soil, the best soil in the world. And we decided that it was a good place for farming. So and that's how we started.
It seems like a pretty bold move to move to an entire different country to do farming.
Yeah, but I have two partners, and they are a little bit older than I am. And they went to Eastern Germany in the beginning of the 90s, as soon as the Iron Curtain or the German Wall came down. So one of them was in Poland and the other one was in the Czech Republic as well. So they already had the experience. And I did an internship in Russia and I worked a little bit in Russia and afterwards in Poland. So, I also kind of knew the world. Of this side of the world, let's call it like this, and so it wasn't too bad. No, it was okay actually.
So then, how many years? When did you come to Ukraine?
January 2003.
Okay, so you're approaching 20 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What has changed in those two decades for you and in that country of Ukraine?
Ukraine was really going uphill. And when I came here, Ukraine was producing like 25 million tons of grains and oilseeds per year. And now, or last year, we were around 100 million tons per year. So in 20 years, we fourfolded our production. And as I said, 20 years ago, half of the land was fallow. And now we are fighting about every acre. So which is good, I guess, in a way. And I mean, the whole logistics improved, the export capacity improved, the ports improved, the yields improved, machines. I mean, everything's changed. And we had this revolution, the Orange Revolution in 2004. When people stood up against corrupted elections, and ever since we have had freedom of press here in Ukraine, And then when this Yanukovych guy was a president, he was suppressing people again. So we had another revolution in 2014. And then the war started, of course, in the East. But so throughout those 20 years, we have always had freedom of press. And so the people were also free in their minds. I had refugees here from Kazakhstan, for example, they originated from Kazakhstan. They lived in the east of Ukraine and they had to flee for the war. And they spent a week here before they moved further west. And they said, when we came here from Kazakhstan 10 years ago, we really felt the freedom of the Ukrainian people. They said, if I compare it to Kazakh people from Kazakhstan or Russia or Belarus, they're not free. They live in a police state. And I say, here in Ukraine, I can swear and shout and call the president all kinds of names. I said, in Kazakhstan, I would have ended up in jail for 3 years. So that's those things I have really experienced as well over the last 20 years.
Well, and growing up in the Netherlands, you're used to freedoms. That wasn't different for you to go to Ukraine. You were used to being able to do lots of those things, right?
Yeah, but I've always felt the freedom here in Ukraine. Of course, it's a little bit more rogue and rough than in the Netherlands and a little bit more bold. But there's a lot of young people who came into business, into governments, into all kind of things, and they were really pushing the country to a modern country, And of course, we need time, but the progress was there, and maybe two steps forward and one step back, or one and a half step back. So, that's how it was going.
What the resistance to grow fourfold? You said land was put into production that had been fallow. There'd been improvements in many other areas, fertilizer, seed, genetics, whatever. What was the opposition, and why wasn't that land used before?
Well, until the fall of the Soviet Union, or the breakup of the Soviet Union, it was all cultivated. Actually, towards the end of the Soviet Union, things were also kind of falling apart because it was just bankrupt. And then throughout the 90s, people, they came out of this plan economy and everything regulated from top down from the state. And then people had to take own initiative and run their businesses in a capitalistic way. Yeah, and of course, they didn't really know how to do this. And some people did, and some didn't. And so they kind of lost it, and it kind of slowly fell apart. And they didn't have diesel for the tractors, or they didn't have spare parts for the tractors. They didn't have money to buy it. I mean, it was going in a negative circle downwards, or a negative spiral downwards. And then in the beginning of the 2000s, half of the land was bare. And Ukraine was only exporting like 25 million tons. That's less than a ton per hectare. I don't know what it is in bushels per acre, but it's really, really, really low.
Yeah. Are you concerned that Ukraine's headed back to what it was in the early 2000s if things continue as they have since February?
No, I'm not sure. No, I don't think so. But we'll be thrown back many, many years in time, of course. But it all depends on the export through the Black Sea. If there's the Russians, they're terrorists. They're damaging civilian infrastructure. And today I was visiting a town close by, having a look at in the pumping stations for water and for heating and stuff. It's all dependent on electricity, and the Russians, they're shooting at the electricity stations you know, so all that stuff doesn't work if there's no electricity. And if they start bombing the infrastructure in the ports on the Black Sea, yeah, I mean, that takes years and years. I mean, it only takes a few bombs to destroy it, and it takes years and years to rebuild it, you know, and that's really going to be an issue then, if we can't, because 90% of our export went through the Black Sea, you know, and you can't replace this by road or by rail. So I'm kind of worried, but on the other side, you know, if they wanted to destroy it, they would have destroyed it already some time ago, you know. So
do you think that if it's not exported, I mean, does it end up somewhere else? Does it waste? Does it go in? Do they take it by rail to Russia? I don't know how the logistics work.
Yeah, that is. Then farmers have to adjust, you know, and find other ways or grow other crops. I mean, of course, in the occupied areas, the Russians, they stole everything. Yeah, so they'll just bring that by train or by truck to Russia and export it like it's from their own ports.
Right, like stamped, like made in Russia, not made in Ukraine.
Yeah, and put a sticker on it, made in Russia. Mm-hmm. And the rest of Ukraine, partly they will export it by train and by truck, and the railroad connections through Poland they are working on improvements, and through Romania they're working on improvements, but it's also a project of years and years, you know, you don't change that overnight,
right?
You know, and the governments are working on easier documentation for trucks with grain driving out of Ukraine, but it's also a bureaucratic headache you can't imagine. But you know, Ukraine is normally exports like 60 million tons of grain and oilseeds, and Poland produces around 30 million tons per year, in Romania like 27 million tons per year. So you know, and that's the two biggest countries through which our export could go by road or by rail, you know, and then, but if we have to export 30 million through Poland and 30 million through Romania, I mean, then we're doubling the amount they have to handle. I mean, that's impossible. It's physical. Right. You don't have to make a calculation, that's just physically impossible to do so. And I mean, to change that infrastructure or to enlarge it, I mean, it takes years.
Yeah, 5%, 10%, but not double. And you're talking about doubling.
Exactly.
Or tripling in some cases. I had a question that somebody wanted me to ask you, and I've always had this concern. What was it like farming in 2022? I mean, do you feel safe out in the fields?
In the beginning, like as of February 24th, first 2-3 weeks, we still kind of were panicking, you know, and didn't know what happening, didn't know what to expect. I mean, I've never had bombs falling on my country, so you don't know where they're dropping, you know, and you don't know where they're aiming, you know. But after like 3-4 weeks, you kind of get used to it, and you start to see how it works, you know. And I mean, a country is so huge, I don't know what's compared to a state in the United States, but the risk of a bomb dropping on your head in the middle of nowhere is still pretty small. So and the front lines were far away, you know, and after a few months Ukraine kind of stopped the Russians and actually started to chase them out. So then it mentally it became easier as well. And I mean, we, of course, for the 22 season, you already start preparing in 21. So we had most of the seeds, most of the fertilizer, most of the crop protection. We started buying a lot of diesel in the beginning, you know, to have it in stock because there was a shortage. because a lot of diesel came from Russia and Belarus, and obviously they didn't deliver that anymore. So farming wise, we were prepared, and we just had to execute it. And we had the machines, so there was not, surprisingly, there was not so too much of a problem actually. And they went more or less smooth. But of course, export, that was a disaster. We still, in the beginning of the war, we still had 5,000 tons of corn left. And normally, that would would take us a week to sell it and get rid of it. And now it took us over 4 months, to drive it out mainly by truck to Romania. So that was a complete headache. And
so I would imagine it's hard to be profitable.
With the grain and oil seeds, it's not very profitable because of increased logistics costs, lower prices because of all kind of bottlenecks. Our colleagues in Germany, they get like $350 per ton for wheat here in ex-farmyard. Here in Ukraine, we get like $170, $180 per ton. Normally the difference would be like $20, $30, $40, but not $150. So, or more. So, yeah. But fertilizer prices went through the roof, fuel prices through the roof. Machines are expensive.
Your follow-up is an easy one about inputs. We'll get to that. But right in the middle of your last answer, a rolling blackout came. How often does that happen?
At least three times a day. So and there's actually a scheme because Russian terrorists, that's the only way I can name them. They bombed all civilian infrastructure, electricity stations, electricity distribution, I don't know how these things are called, transformer stations, whatever. So there's a lack of energy, lack of electricity, and so they switch it off every now and then, so they redivide it all over the country. And actually, it's more or less at 10 o'clock in the morning, they switch it off till 12. Then from 4 in the afternoon till 6 in the afternoon. And then from 10 in the evening till 12 o'clock at night. And then sometimes in between as well. So
And the reason is just to what?
Yeah, because the Russians bombed all these electricity stations and transformer stations, civilian infrastructure. So there's not enough capacity in the country anymore to provide the whole country with electricity. So you have to divide it among the people.
So you're saying the blackouts are more because your current system is overwhelmed? And so then are these planned blackouts, or I might not be quite following you here, Keys?
No, they are now planned because the Russians destroyed the system. The system was good enough for the whole country, but because the Russians destroyed like up to 40%, I think there's not then the system is not good enough anymore, of course. And that's so, and then for at least everybody to have some electricity, they switched off in a planned way. So, can prepare. So if you have to cook, for example, or you have to make sure you do it before 4 o'clock or after 6 o'clock, for example. Or if you have to, people in the villages, they have to feed the animals which they have at home. They boil potatoes and all kinds of stuff, so they have to make sure they do it at the right time.
Are there efforts to repair infrastructure, or is it kind of seem futile until this is over?
No, they are repairing it constantly, It's okay. Easier. It's easier and faster to throw a bomb on it than to repair it.
Okay. Let's go back to inputs. How high are those in comparison to 21?
Oh, I think they 4 times higher.
Yeah.
Fertilizer prices, fuel prices, 2 times higher. They were four times higher, but they came down a bit. Crop protection hasn't really increased a lot, but it's not everything's available. And machine prices have also gone through the roof. But I think that has more to do with COVID than with the war here, because most of the machines came. I mean, if they came from America, they came by boat to Germany and from there by truck to Ukraine. So that logistic chain hasn't changed. So, spare parts availability, companies, dealers, tractor dealers, machine dealers, they're afraid to put huge stocks because of the war. So, so spare part, if something breaks down, you have to wait a long time before the spare parts are there.
Your source of fertilizer and fuel, I'm guessing it used to be Russia. Where is it now?
A lot came from Russia. Now, the Ukrainians, they bought, I think, all the fuel trucks all over Europe, and they started trucking diesel fuel into the country from the Baltic states, from Poland, from Romania, from Bulgaria, even from Greece. So the fuel is enough there now. And fertilizer, that's going to be a big issue. Phosphate and potassium mainly came from Russia and Belarus. I don't think we're going to buy it there now. And nitrogen was a lot produced here in Ukraine, but I mean with gas, and gas came from Russia as well, so that's also going to be an issue. So nitrogen went through the roof. Nitrogen prices, I mean, in some factories in Germany and the Netherlands, they stopped producing nitrogen. But I think we will get nitrogen from the Middle East and from Northern Africa. And phosphorus and potassium, I'm not sure yet. So we bought all kinds of leftovers throughout the summer. And we are buying a lot of chicken manure. And we have our own dairy farm, so we have the manure from the dairy. So, I want a long-term strategy. I want to use more manure and less fertilizer.
So, yeah, tell me about your operation. We got going on the heavy stuff, and we didn't even get a chance to tell everybody what it is you grow and produce.
Yeah, we have 15,000 hectares. That's like 40,000 acres. We grow winter wheat, winter barley, winter canola, sugar beets, sunflowers, corn, and soybeans. And we have also 300 hectares of vegetables, onions, and carrots with drip irrigation. And we have storages for this as well, 10,000 tons of storages for onions and like 5,000 for carrots. And we have 2,000 herd dairy farm plus young stock. That's also our advantage because of the vegetables, which we sell locally and the prices are extremely high. And because of the dairy, which is also sold locally, we still have a stable income and a good income. If you would have only had grain, I mean, then it would be a lot more complicated.
Prior to February, did you sell as much local?
Oh, the milk and vegetables were all sold locally. And
so that's continued.
That's continued. But the vegetables are so expensive because the south part of Ukraine, Kherson Oblast, that's where most of the vegetables were grown. And that's occupied. So there's no vegetables coming from there anymore. Mm-hmm. So the vegetable production in Ukraine dropped dramatically. And therefore the prices are extremely high. So we are kind of profiting from this.
I heard you speak at the World Food Prize Global Symposium. You are also involved with the Global Farm Network. Why did you feel it was important to accept the invitation to speak at the Borlaug Dialogue?
That's an honor, of course. Kind of, you know. So, and I mean, I've been a member of Global Farm Network since I think 13 or 14, I can't remember exactly, or maybe even 2012. So then, back then, we visited the Borlaug Dialogue, and I mean, it was really interesting, of course, to see and listen to it. It was kind of unexpected for me. I was just doing my job here, you know, and I wanted the war to be over, so I started to inform everybody, and I mean, all the. A lot of media people, a lot of politicians, and with the Global Farmer Network, we are in a group of farmers worldwide, as you know, with more than, I think there's close to 200 members already, you know, so we're with them in a WhatsApp group. So I was sending them text messages as well and pictures and giving them updates of the war here in Ukraine and what it meant for farming and for world food supply. Because, you know, Ukraine is like more than 10% of the world food supply comes from Ukraine. You know, if you take that out of the equation, then it's a huge catastrophe, disaster for world food supply, and that's what we see now as the prices increased. So when I started posting all this stuff, and towards the end of the summer, the Global Farmer Network said, "Well, you get the Kleckner Award for your exposure in the media." So I was kind of surprised, and then and with this came also the invitation for the World Food Prize. Yeah, you can't decline it, of course.
Do you feel that your outspokenness might get you into trouble?
I'm not sure if I'm so outspoken. Just telling why.
No, well, there's some that would consider that to be outspoken.
Well, I just consider it transparency. So, I mean, that's the least I can do. You know, there's a lot of guys standing there in the front lines and hiding for bullets. So. You know, and fighting for our freedom, and I mean not only the freedom of me and the people here in Ukraine, but I guess also for the freedom of first people in Western Europe, but also people of the free world, you know, and against terrorists, you know, against terroristic states, against dictators. So, you know, if we let them win, or if the Western world or the civilized world or whatever you want to call it, lets them win, you know, then it's over with normal people, I would say. No, then the world will keep on being manipulated by those kind of guys. I don't think that's something we should want.
Well, I was just going to have you summarize to the United States audience why they should be caring about what it is that you're doing, but you just did that incredibly well. Keese, I appreciate your time so much. Good luck to you. I understand I need to let you get back to the dryer and you hopefully get some electricity back soon.
I'm going to sleep now.
Time to go to bed.
I've spent the whole day in the dryer, so it's more or less adjusted now because we... also because of the war, we used to dry on gas, natural gas, and we reconstructed the dryer to wood chips. So we have a lot of tree lines in between our fields, and we clean them, and we chop them into little wood chips. And now we are burning the wood chips and drying it. So and we have a heat exchanger. We made a heat exchanger over the summer. But, of course, we have to learn how to work with it. And it was kind of my design. So I have to explain the guys how to work with, you know, and then last night they messed up. And so the whole day we had to clean it and get things straight again. And now it's now 10:30 in the night. So a few hours ago we got it working, but then I had to adjust it again, of course. And but now it works. And tomorrow morning I'll see if it still works.
I appreciate you so much slipping us into your schedule, and good luck to you, and I certainly hope to talk to you in this soon, when hopefully this is all over.
Thank you.
My sincere thanks to Keys for his time. Good luck to him. If you have feedback for me, market2market@iowapbs.org is the best email to use. New episodes of this podcast come out each and every Tuesday. We'll see you next time right here for Market to Market.